Chapter 13 Coruscant, Jedi Temple. Mara leaned forward, elbows on the table on either side of the datapad retrieved from Lumia's quarters, and rested her chin in her hands. From the other side of the table, Luke looked at her. "You cracked the encryption on the data card?"
"Finally."
"But you don't look happy."
"You don't need a force bond to tell that, farm boy."
"Tell me."
"Some of it's an invoice. The sender seems to have been a bounty hunter working for Lumia, and the invoice is an itemized list of expenses. Hours worked, fuel expended, blaster shots taken. The main part, though, is a mission status and event report. Even decrypted, it's hard to puzzle out. Everything is referred to by code words, but assuming I'm putting the right names to some of these code words, the information is interesting."
"Such as?"
"Confirmed that the lady's daughter succumbed to injuries inflicted by grandson 32707.
Mara recited.
"Please inform if lady's mission changed from insertion observation to revenge."
Luke frowned over that one. "Lady has to be Lumia. She used to style herself the Dark Lady of the Sith. After Emperor Palpatine and my father were no longer around to slap her down for presumption."
"I agree. And if that same time context is the basis for more than one of these code names, grandson would therefore have to be one of Darth Vader's grandsons, right? Jason or Ben?"
32707, Luke said. "Just a second." He pulled out his datapad, connected it remotely to the temple's computer, and went searching for a report Ben had filed weeks earlier. "Here it is. BMX-32707. An uninhabited star system near Bimiel. That's where the woman Sio led Jason and Ben. Where Jason defeated some sort of dark side force user within the asteroid under her habitat.
Where Nalani Din died."
Mara looked confused.
"Nalani was Lumia's daughter?"
"No, Nalani's parents have files in the Order database. And Nalani looked a lot like her mother. Besides, Nalani died the same day Jason and Ben arrived at the habitat. Your file there suggests that the lady's daughter lingered for a while." Luke frowned. "The other woman who was there, Brisha Sio. Brisha could be an anagram for Shira B."
"Shira Bree?"
"Lumia's real name."
Luke nodded. "I didn't make the connection at the time, because then it had been years since we'd heard anything about Lumia." A thought was growing within him, and alongside it, a worry. A big one. "Let's say Lumia has a daughter. She names her Brisha, a self-tribute, and Brisha works with her. Brisha lures Jason and Ben to an ambush. She and the mysterious Sith she claims is living in her basement. Maybe he's just a dark Jedi she's hired. Maybe he's Lumia's Sith apprentice. Are going to kill Ben. An act of revenge for everything I've done to Lumia. Or maybe to capture him, train him to be a Sith. Which is just as much revenge. And twice the evil."
"I did a thing or two to her as well."
"Right. Revenge against both of us. But Nalani is there, too, and throws the odds off. The Darksider and Nalani are killed. Brisha is badly wounded. Ben gets a knock in the head and forgets what happened. And Jason presumably never figures out that Brisha was one of the bad guys. Jason and Ben leave, and weeks later, Brisha succumbs to injuries."
"And her mother?"
Mara winced.
"Her mother would want revenge. Against Jason. He's racking up quite a body count against daughters of dangerous opponents of ours. Luke shook his head. We don't know that Jason wounded Brescia. How could he have done so and then left the habitat without thinking of her as an enemy? Ben must have done it, during one of the periods of time his memory doesn't cover, which would make Ben the target. His stomach began doing flip-flops. In addition to being a cocky teenager alone in a galaxy at war, Ben might now be the target of one of the galaxy's deadliest killers, a woman who had fought Luke to a standstill mere weeks before.
Your theory spooks me, farm boy, because it answers a lot of the questions we've been asking. Why Lumia would have infiltrated the Galactic Alliance Guard to gather information about Jason or Ben and prepare for revenge if she needed to take it. Why she would have been around for as long as we've known she has been, but didn't attack you until a few weeks ago. Because that's when she received the word about her daughter dying.
Her frown deepened.
And what if this is the reason for all Jason's bad decisions? What if Brescia or the Sith apprentice on that planetoid got to him, affected him, infected him in some way?
Then whatever's afflicting him might be easily curable. Mara slammed her fists down on the tabletop and turned away from Luke. Far from being pleased by that possibility, she'd been angered by it. And even without the benefit of their force bond, Luke thought he knew why. Because if Jason were the victim of some Sith brainwashing technique, he wasn't responsible for his recent actions. In which case, Mara couldn't forge and sharpen her emotions, her dedication to oppose and eliminate him, as a former Emperor's hand should be able to.
We have to find out what happened on that asteroid, Luke said, and we have to confront Jason face to face to do that. We can't be in a position where all he has to do is press an off switch to shut us out.
I agree.
Mara's voice was strained. I'll make the arrangements.
Before you go,
a little pain crept into Mara's voice.
Luke, who was Brescia's father?
Luke shrugged as he rose. How would I know? Then he caught the look on her face, a combination of suspicion and an eagerness to let any answer wipe that suspicion away, and he said, No.
You're sure?
He offered her a reassuring grin. Mara, we were involved emotionally, but not physically.
All right.
The suspicion eased from her expression, but through their force bond, Luke could still feel a touch of disquiet from her. As Luke hurried off to make flight arrangements to Corellia, he cursed Lumia for managing to introduce strife, however fleeting, into his life, this time without even trying. Corellian Exclusion Zone, Errant Venture. The universe was not cooperating, and Alima Rar was becoming impatient with it. There was a Jedi other than herself aboard Errant Venture. She was sure of it. As she stalked the darkened passageways and shadow-filled casinos, as she wandered wrapped in robes that concealed her disfigurement enough to allow her to mingle with drunken gamblers and revelers, she would occasionally feel little pulses and eddies in the Force that were characteristic of Jedi presence. But she never spotted the Jedi. To the logic she employed in her calculations, that meant one thing. The Jedi was hiding. Hiding from her, and therefore it was Leia. That evening, in the cabin she surreptitiously shared with Captain Levent, she spoke of these matters.
You are almost free of your debt to us,
she said.
You have brought us to where the Solos, at least Leia, conceal themselves. But we cannot find her. Them. When we see them, Then you are free.
I'm in no hurry, Levent said. She sat cross-legged on the bed, a small bottle of expensive pre-war Corellian whiskey trapped between her ankles.
You and I, that is, not just me, are making a killing at the gambling tables. Did you ever think about giving up your quest, whatever it is, and turning pro?
No.
All right. Here's a hint, then. You're using only Jedi magic, and your royal we instead of your brain.
Ordinarily, Alima would have been offended by such a declaration. She would not necessarily have demonstrated it, except to exact a little revenge. But Levent was not trying to insult. She simply had no filter between her brain and her mouth. Whatever she thought came tumbling out, particularly when she had some alcohol in her.
Tell us, then, what we are doing wrong, what we are not thinking.
Levent raised a forefinger.
One. What is Han Solo?
Adventurer, friend to Jedi, husband, father, smuggler, general, ship captain.
Those are all the branches, except smuggler. That's the trunk. Corellian smuggler.
She raised two more fingers.
Two. Wedge Antilles, who just vanished from Corellia. What's he?
That's three.
Eh?
That's three fingers, not two.
Levent glared down at her hand and folded one of her fingers down.
Antilles.
General, admiral, pilot, husband, father, friend to Jedi.
And when he was just starting, a Corellian smuggler.
Alima looked at her suspiciously.
Is this the speech about Corellian smugglers?
Yes.
Levent raised the third finger into place again.
Three. What's Booster Tarek?
Businessman, ship owner, and, we must guess, Corellian smuggler?
Retired.
Levent smiled.
You're catching on. Also father of a daughter named Mirax Tarek. What's she?
Corellian smuggler.
Good. We've got the trunks all laid out. They grow from the same ground. Corellian smugglerhood. Now, where do the branches come together? Han Solo is married to Leia Organa, so there's a Jedi connection. And not just any Jedi connection, because Leia's the sister of the Grand Master. Antilles is married to an ex-New Republic intelligence agent, so he's got branches into Galactic Alliance intelligence. Booster's daughter is married to Corrin Horn, another Jedi, with branches into Corsec. Horn and Antilles flew together. I've been doing more research on them. Antilles has a daughter named for Tarek's daughter. You see how tight the branches are?
Alima added it up.
So the Solos are here because of all their friends, the security they represent.
And money, and resources. And you're not going to find them in the Deep Core Lounge because they don't have to mingle. They're all in it together with the owner of the entire establishment. You've been wandering the public areas while they're probably all on the bridge, drinking and laughing together.
Alima felt a sudden flush of gratitude that she had not killed this woman. It was a rare emotion for her.
We must begin to search other places.
Yes, and right away, so I can get some sleep.
Bathawi System, Shamanar. On the records and assignment sheets, A thin screen of starfighters and armored shuttles, equipped with long-range sensors, guarded the rimward edge of the star system. If the fleets that were assembling, performing maneuvers and war games, and otherwise rattling their lasers deep within the system, were to head out in the direction of the outer rim, toward, say, Kamino, directly opposite the direction a fleet would most logically take if headed toward Corellia, this screen would detect it and transmit that information to Shamanar for retransmission to the Second Fleet. The Bothans would not be able to take the task force at Corellia by surprise. In theory. In fact, Admiral Klauskin had identified a number of this task force's pilots and officers as traitors. He'd been very careful to flag the ones whom Captain Bjork had already written up for various disciplinary reasons, and to avoid those Bjork indicated he trusted implicitly. Then Klauskin had assigned each of them to the outer rim screen. He and Bjork had positioned Shamanar at the heart of that coverage area, and had called in each of those on-duty pilots in turn, arresting them and seizing their vehicles. Now, though they were still officially on station, each of the alleged traitors was in the brig, and Shamanar floated alone, doing the work of the entire screen by herself. She was more than fit for the job, of course. She had been fitted with the best long-range sensor suites a frigate could boast. It was unfortunate that she couldn't remain at her usual station, well outside the Bathawi system on the Bathawi-Corellia approach corridor. But there she was nearly redundant. Here she was doing critical work.
"Don't worry," Klauskin told Bjork. "I've transmitted news of our success to Admiral Niafel. She'll be sending replacement vehicles immediately."
"Good to know."
Bjork stood in the middle of the bridge and turned to look at each officer's display in turn. He was restless, and would continue to be until all those replacement forces were in place.
"Your officers look bored."
Bjork gave the admiral a surprised look.
"I don't think so, sir."
"Still, let's shake them up a bit. I spent part of yesterday putting together a simulation. In the sim, the three Bothan fleets stage a simultaneous breakout, and one heads straight for Shamanar. There's opportunity for a stand-up fight, or for picking off their weaker units."
Bjork smiled at the admiral's mistake.
"Just telling me that affects my tactics, Admiral."
"So it does. Well, put your second-in-command in charge. You and I will run things from the auxiliary bridge."
"Right."
Bjork turned toward his second, a tall Gotal.
"Lieutenant Ciro, you have the bridge for a sim. The Admiral and I will be running it from the auxiliary bridge."
Moments later, Klauskin and Bjork walked into the auxiliary bridge, a small, seldom-used chamber, its walls more thickly lined with displays than any other compartment on the frigate. These displays were just now flickering into life, as were the overhead lights. The bridge doors slid shut behind the two men.
"All overrides default here, correct?"
Klauskin asked.
"It wouldn't be much use as an emergency bridge if they didn't,"
Bjork said.
"Oh, sorry, Admiral. I didn't mean to sound sarcastic."
"You really ought to watch your mouth, son,"
Klauskin said. From his pocket, he pulled a holdout blaster. Bjork's eyes widened, as if he thought the admiral's gesture were a not-too-funny joke about disciplinary measures. Klauskin shot him in the chest. Bjork went down on his back, the impact making the floor panels ring. Smoke curled up from the scorched patch over his breastbone, and a little blood oozed from the burned flesh. He tried to speak,
to reach for his comlink, but Klauskin sadly shook his head and fired two more times. There, one grim task out of the way. Using the codes he'd just heard Bjork use to open and activate the auxiliary bridge, Klauskin ensured that the doors could not be opened again. Then he moved to the communications board. He activated a line to the main bridge and said, "Lieutenant Zero, I'm cutting all external communications. From this point on, any communications you make will actually be going to the SIM program. If you get an override message from the fleet, it will be accompanied by a red blink that indicates I'm the real thing. Understood?"
"Yes, sir."
Klauskin punched in controls that would disable all communications antennas aboard the frigate. All but one, which he reserved for use of his own comm board. He moved to the main computer and inserted a data card into its slot. The computer accepted the program and activated it. All over the ship, every internal door or hatch controlled by a servo slid and locked open. Klauskin imagined the officers on the bridge staring in puzzlement at the doors as intership communications began buzzing with questions. The door into this bridge remained resolutely shut, of course. It wouldn't do for Klauskin to die with the others, though even if he did, his primary mission would still be successful. The main computer display came up with a text message indicating that all safety protocols concerning exterior hatches had been overridden. Klauskin nodded. All he had to do now was stand by, though he did have 10 seconds in which he could abort this sequence. He didn't. And when the 10th second counted down, warning lights and chime alarms began to fill the air. Klauskin switched the main display from view to view. First was the interior of the frigate's small starfighter bay, where the force field holding the atmosphere had just dissipated. Atmosphere rushed out through the great gaping hole through which starfighters normally launched or landed, and some of the starfighters in the bay rocked slightly. A lone mechanic standing too close to the main opening stumbled, forced along by the air currents fleeing into space, and was swept into the void. Her arms flailed as she drifted out toward explosive decompression and death. The next view showed personnel in the ship's mess. They stood looking around, their eyes wild, as they began gulping for air. Some began running for emergency control panels and wall comm boards. Others turned around and around, looking for the source of their trouble. All over the frigate, it was the same. Every exterior hatch or portal was open and was pouring precious atmosphere into a vacuum that would drink until it was all gone. Only the auxiliary bridge was safe, and Klauskin could feel cool air blowing onto his neck from an overhead vent. He switched the display to look at the bridge. The holocam view from the bridge was dominated by the face of the human communications officer. He was so close to the holocam that his features were distorted. To either side of him, other bridge officers stood, shouting, clutching their throats. This wouldn't take long. And when it was done, he would be a hero of Kaminor. Somehow the thought, so reassuring across the last several days, failed to lighten the heaviness he felt in his chest. He returned to the comm board and punched in a frequency, then activated it. "Klauskin to Croylan. Please respond." A moment later, the face of a black and tan Bothan appeared on the display.
"Croylan here."
"The eye is closed, and Shamanar is ready for a prize crew. She'll be repressurized by the time you get here.
Croylan smiled.
And exactly on time, Admiral. I admire your punctuality.
Then his expression became one of concern.
Are you all right?
Yes, of course. Why?
You seem to be crying.
Klauskin reached up. His fingers found tears on his cheeks. That startled him. But it would not do for this Bothan to see him discomfited.
Ah, yes. A result of the atmospheric pressure changes aboard.
Of course.
The smile returned.
My crew will be there soon. Croylan out.
Corellian Exclusion Zone. Errant Venture. Leia and Luke embraced for a long moment, uncaring that they were surrounded by observers. Those observers were family and friends, and though the private conference room Booster had set aside for his secret guests wasn't exactly as cozy as the vessel's more sumptuous suites, its shortcomings of comfort did not matter. Luke drew away from his sister and followed Mara's lead in shaking hands or offering embraces all around. Han, Lando, Wedge, Corrin, Mirax. "It's good to see you," he said. The words were simple, but they came from his heart. It startled him to feel this level of relief at seeing people in person when he already knew they were alive and well. But he supposed the heart did not always believe what the mind knew to be true.
"Us too,"
Han said, and it was apparent that the distance that had developed between the two men, back when it became clear that Han supported Corellian independence while Luke remained loyal to the Alliance, had finally closed.
"Though we're kind of surprised to see you here."
"We were in the neighborhood," Mara said. "Not a joke. We're in the Corellian system to see if we can pin Jason down. Get a few answers from him. Ben is missing."
Leia did not miss the little flash of pain visible in Mara's face, detectable through the Force.
"We don't think Jason knows where he is, but he has some information that might lead us to Ben."
"You've chosen a good time to visit, then," Wedge said. "Jason is here, aboard Errant Venture."
Luke gave him a dubious look.
"Jason? Gambling?"
"No." Corrin shook his head, clearly annoyed. "He's wandering around looking things over. Maybe he's come to the same conclusion we did. But Errant Venture is a very useful tool for gathering data. Seems a very GAG thing for him to think of. Or maybe he wants to make sure that the ship doesn't constitute a security leak that would help the Corellians. Either way, he's here. So those of us he knows are having to keep even more out of sight." "No more gambling, even in disguise, until he goes away," Han added.
"There's something else," Leia said. "Something I've been sensing through the Force for the last few days. There's a presence aboard ship. Someone or something I can't identify. But it's here. Watchful."
"I'll keep that in mind," Luke said. "You won't be offended if Mara and I go to pin Jason with some questions in a few minutes."
Leia shook her head. "Just be careful."
"Count on it."
Luke seemed to hesitate before continuing. "In the meantime, there are some things we need to bring you up to date on."
"Such as Alima Rar and Lumia, Dark Lady of the Sith," Mara said. "And we now have a little Force technique developed by Master Silgal that will help us counter the way Alima meddles with memory. We'll teach you."
Jason stopped a few meters from one of the tables in the Maw Casino. Like so many of the individual dens on this ship, this one was named for a particular planet or region of space and decorated accordingly. As the Maw was an area where clustered black holes surrounded a hidden region, swallowing all light, the Maw Casino was dark, its walls black. Its silvery tables were edged with dim glow rods, and there was no overhead lighting. The servers and other casino personnel wore piping, jewelry, and accoutrements that glowed. The decor made the casino an intimate one, a place where conversations could be nearly private, where trysts could be arranged or conducted with little fear of discovery. The table Jason stopped to watch was a micro-droid wrestling betting table. Inset into the glowing tabletop were numerous displays. Several showed combat taking place in another chamber aboard ship, combat between droids no longer than 10 centimeters, droids designed and programmed by hobbyists whose chief occupation was pitting their designs against one another. Other displays showed the odds of bets being laid on the combatants. In the duel currently taking place, a droid shaped like a piranha beetle on treads exchanged fire with one shaped like a Tatooine sandcrawler. They were separated by a few meters of artificial terrain resembling the towering forests of Kashyyyk. But it wasn't the droid fight that drew Jason's attention. It was the woman facing him from the center of the long edge of the table. He knew her face, and he'd never expected to see it again. He circled the table so that it would not be between them, and stepped up next to her. Captain Uren Levint looked up from her bedding and her drink to nod at him.
"Colonel Solo."
"Captain Levint, how did you get here?"
"That's a silly question, isn't it? I got here on the cargo vehicle you gave me."
She lifted her drink, tilted the container toward him in salute, and took a sip.
"Please forgive me for not thanking you before now. The Duracrud has become a good luck charm for me. My fortunes have been improving ever since I took command of her. I've run 3 cargo routes, all at a tremendous profit."
"You haven't had any difficulty with her?"
"Well, she's old. I spent part of your payment to me giving her an overhaul, but nothing catastrophic."
Jason stared down at her, baffled. Jedi could often tell when someone was lying, and Levint was clearly withholding information, but she didn't manifest any of the emotion that should accompany the lies he expected. If her hyperdrive had failed, she should be angry with him. She was not. If she were covering up the fact that he had ruined her financial fortunes with his actions, she should radiate resentment. She did not. Something had gone wrong with his final instructions concerning her. But he'd sort that out with his next few questions. Then he felt a slight flicker within the Force. He looked up to see Luke and Mara standing just inside the casino entrance, staring at him. He gave the captain a purely artificial smile.
"We'll get caught up later."
"Looking forward to it. You can buy me a drink."
Pushing Levint from his mind, he approached Luke and Mara, offering each a civil handshake.
"Master Skywalker, you should have told me you were coming to Corellia."
"Where would you have been if we had?"
Mara asked.
Jason blinked at the question. "Aboard the Anakin Solo, probably."
He did not add, "and able to limit the time I would have to spend with you." Luke gave him a cheerful smile.
"Well, it's nice that we could find you when you have more time for socializing. Let's get a table. Order drinks."
Not waiting for a reply, he turned and led the way into the ranks of small tables closer to the bar. He chose an empty one that appeared to have been recently cleaned. Its glowing, glossy surface was still damp, and sat. Mara and Jason joined him. Jason had to struggle just a bit to keep annoyance from his face. This encounter was inconvenient. The server, a Bothan female with silver-gray fur, not much of it covered by her abbreviated black dress, materialized to take their drinks. Once she was gone, Luke leaned in close.
"Jason, this is important. We need to know exactly what happened on the asteroid near Bimiel."
Jason kept his emotions under tight control and attempted to project nothing more than additional annoyance. But inwardly he felt relief, a return of confidence. Luke and Mara had obviously already found the leads Lumia's people had planted. All he had to do was keep straight the details she had sent him.
"It's true, I haven't had time to write a report. My guard commission came in too soon after our return to Coruscant. Was there something wrong with Ben's report?"
"Well, it's incomplete," Mara said. "It doesn't cover what happened while he was unconscious, or what happened to you while you were separated from him."
"Oh, of course."
Jason frowned as if trying to dig up memories buried beneath tons of more recent events.
"Well, let's just concentrate on those two periods, then. Brescia Sio, Nalani, Ben, and I boarded a sort of rail car that took us into the asteroid's interior. A pulse of force energy yanked Ben and Nalani out of the car. After a moment, Brescia was yanked free. The car stopped in a deep cavern, and there I was attacked by a force user who radiated dark side orientation and wore your face, Luke."
Luke nodded. "At the same time, I was fighting a force projection with your appearance, an altered appearance, and Mara and Ben were fighting distorted versions of each other."
"That's right."
Jason's mind clicked its way through the details Lumia had so recently provided as he tried to figure out the best order in which to present the information.
"My duel ended when the false Luke hurled some boulders at me, and I inverted into a spin with my lightsaber. We both connected. I took a rock to the head and was out for a while. But when I woke up, my opponent was in two pieces, and once I found his head several meters away, I could see his true features. A Deveronian. He had no identicard on him. His lightsaber was gone."
"Gone?" Mara frowned. "So someone came while you were unconscious and took it." Jason shrugged as if the detail was of no importance.
"Probably it just went flying into a cranny somewhere and I couldn't find it. It was a very low-gravity environment. You could throw a lightsaber hilt a kilometer if you tried."
"And Ben?" Luke asked.
"I found him in an upper cavern," Jason said, "unconscious. Brescia Sio was nearby. She'd lost an arm and had sustained a head injury and sucking chest wound, all of them lightsaber-inflicted. I stabilized her. She seemed pretty sure her habitat's medical droids would be able to fix her up. She said she found a wicked-looking redhead. Her description matched Ben's evil Mara, preparing to behead Ben, and that she interfered. She was badly wounded, but drove the false Mara into retreat."
Luke and Mara exchanged a glance.
"So," Luke said, "if she was telling the truth, the timing can only work out one way. The Dark Jedi, or whatever he was, impersonated Mara and attacked Ben. He won that fight. Brescia stopped him from killing Ben, and he ran off. Then he took my face and attacked Jason, and Jason killed him. Mara shook her head.
That doesn't work, though, if we assume there was some link between the two Jason-Luke fights and the two Ben-Mara fights. Because my fight with the false Ben and your fight with the false Jason were simultaneous.
Suggesting that my fight with the false Luke and Ben's with the false Mara were too.
Jason pretended to puzzle that one over.
The only logical conclusion is that there were two enemies in those caverns, not just one.
That's right. Luke returned his attention to Jason. He hesitated a moment before continuing. Jason, we have evidence that Brescia Seo was Lumia's daughter. Jason sat back and allowed a look of startlement to cross his features.
I don't believe it. I'm not that easy to deceive.
She'd be very good at deception, Mara said, if she were trained by her mother.
So, Jason pretended to think it through. So Brescia probably killed Nelani, and Brescia dueled Ben.
And Ben cut her to ribbons.
A little pride crept into Mara's voice with that remark.
But she defeated him with some ploy, and she probably did something to him, altering his memories, maybe making him vulnerable to other techniques just before you came across them.
And now, Jason told himself, the test of courage. Do you propose to me that my memories were meddled with, too? That my thinking has been altered?
Luke did seem to be on the verge of saying something else when he looked up and around. A moment later, Jason and Mara felt it, too. A massive surge of surprise, consternation, other emotions from another direction joined the mix. Fear, exultation, anger. Those emotions had to be projected by hundreds, even thousands of people simultaneously to manifest like this through the Force. Jason grabbed his comlink and spoke into it.
Colonel Solo to the Anakin Solo. Status check.
Sir, Jason recognized the voice. It belonged to one of the Anakin Solo's communications officers. There was silence for a few moments.
Fleet action, sir. There's a fleet. Incoming. They're everywhere. They're already hitting the task force around Corellia proper.
Jason stood and ran toward the door leading from the Maw Casino. He grazed the returning Bothan server, spinning her, sending three full drinks to the carpet.